From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. A word that gets thrown around a lot in the food world is authenticity. Sometimes it gets used as criteria, kind of a litmus test to judge if something is the real deal, whether that has to do with food or people.
There's no one Japanese way of eating, and we want to kind of dispel this notion of Japan as one singular thing.
But what if the idea of authenticity is more slippery than we think?
You know, it's the German schnitzel, which became the tonkatsu. It's the curry rice that came from England, you know, via India. But it's a completely Japanese dish.
Ivan Orkin is the chef and restaurateur behind Ivan Ramen in New York. He's practically a unicorn in the highly competitive world of ramen chefs. For one, he's Jewish, and he hails from Long Island. Together with Chris Ying, he's written a book about Japanese home cooking from an outsider's point of view. It's called The Gaijin Cookbook. So, Chris, I understand it was your idea for the cookbook's title. Could you explain the term and why you just wanted to throw it out there?
Well, Ivan and I had talked for a while about doing another cookbook after we did our first one that was more of a memoir of Ivan's life. And we really wanted to do a book that was about actual home cooking, the things that Ivan ate at home, the things that he had taught me to eat and cook, and, you know, which were primarily Japanese dishes or Japanese-based dishes that he had picked up in his decades of living there. And it is a tricky time to try to cook food that, you know, quote unquote, doesn't belong to you. But the more we thought about it, the more we understood that, like, that all food comes from somewhere else, and that the only way to move cuisine forward is to respectfully and curiously embrace other people's traditions. And that is what Ivan has always done, and he's been a student of it for so long. And it dawned on me and him at some point that trying to do anything but lean into and embrace his status as an outsider was silly, and we should just own it and try to make an example of the way that he has approached this. And so that word gaijin means outsider. That's like the sort of official definition, outsider or foreigner or just not Japanese. But it has always carried this connotation of being a derogatory term, sometimes with, you know, said with malice and sometimes just sort of in jest and sometimes just very literally. And so I said, let's not hide this. Let's just make this the Gaijin cookbook. And I think from the beginning, Ivan was comfortable with it.
Yeah, I am. A Gaijin.
Ivan, how were you originally drawn to Japan, its food and its culture?
Well, I mean, when I was 15, I got a job at the new Japanese restaurant in the town I grew up in Syosset, Long Island. It was my first paying job, and I was always a busy worker, and it was great. But what I didn't know is how much I would fall in love with the smells and the sounds and the activity of a restaurant. So in that respect, it didn't have anything to do with the Japanese part. I discovered that I loved just being the mix of that. And yet the Japanese part was intriguing to me because I didn't understand the language, but everybody spoke it. And I loved the flavors and the taste of all the food. And the chefs were really nice to me. And it really stuck with me because I knew, you know, I was just a 15-year-old. Why would a 25-year-old guy be nice to a pipsqueak like me? But they were. And so as my life kind of progressed, I held on to this special feeling, and it kind of grew and grew and grew. It sort of got bigger over time. And now it's just like I feel like the whole Ivan Ramen thing and the Gaijin cookbook thing is my attempt to get the world to notice Japan more. And I want to share my excitement. And I feel like sometimes I feel like, you know, Japan gets short shrift a little bit because it's a little far away. It's a little, you know, mysterious. It's a little expensive to get there. And so, you know, well-traveled people still tell me all the time, you know, my dream is to go to Japan, which I'm always a little mildly offended by.
Which is so interesting because all it takes is to go there once to become kind of obsessed by it.
Chris and I were talking about that earlier. It's you know, people, they put off going for years. And then when they come back, they're like, oh my God, I can't believe I find, oh my God, I can't wait to go back. Why did I wait so long? And I'm like, well, because you didn't listen to me.
When you say in the book to eat more Japanese, what do you mean? What principles are we to follow?
It's this idea of thinking about your surroundings and caring more about people. And, you know, sometimes I don't know if you've ever lived abroad, but, you know, I lived abroad for a long time. And then when I came back to the United States, I experienced kind of reverse culture shock, you know, and I'm like riding on the commuter train and people are putting their dirty shoes up on the seat in front of them. And I'm like, no. Someone might sit there and get their pants dirty. Why are you doing that? You know, and so there's this feeling of Japan in me that wants to sort of be more aware of others and being a little more kinder. And
yeah, and I think that notion of eating more Japanese, and we acknowledge this in the book, is kind of, we say it somewhat facetiously, there's no one Japanese way of eating. And we want to kind of dispel this notion of Japan as one singular thing, too. And, you know, there are principles that are you can really admire about the way that Japanese cuisine is formed. You know, it's attention to detail. It's kind of a variety of dishes and flavors and textures and tastes all at the same time. It's, you know, this really deft hand with umami and not just kind of using umami like a sledgehammer. And these things that are actually not really what you associate with, quote unquote, eating more Japanese. So when we talk about that, we talk about it sort of as a winking nod that people think of Japanese food as one thing. But one of the big things, like Ivan said, is making people love Japan more, but also just see it as a place with people that aren't exactly what you think. It's not with the cuisine that isn't exactly what you think. And as the Japanese experience as being very similar to our own and encompassing all of the same sort of day-to-day rituals and trials and tribulations of putting food on the table.
So, Ivan, you're an inveterate tinkerer. Anyone who's read your ramen book knows that you have a deep love of investigation.
Right.
But when it comes to home cooking, surely you must arrive at the place of comfort quicker, but maybe not, given that this teriyaki sauce is 12.0.
Well, I mean, 12.0, and I think Chris came up with that because we were talking about, I would call him and I'd be like, oh, I did another teriyaki sauce today. It was totally what happened. I'd be like, call him on the phone. We talk so much and I'd be cooking and I'd kind of give him play-by-play of stuff I was working on because it was sort of like a very organic creation of all these recipes. And, you know, Chris is a real taskmaster about, you know, he'll call up and say, well, how many, we need this many recipes. How many are you going to work on this week? And so I would get busy and I'd make a list and I would start working on stuff. But while I was making things that I was familiar with, I would also start to play around with other things that could be added in. And I think I was playing around with the teriyaki sauce a lot and having a lot of fun with it. And I kept coming up with different ratios and different ideas. And some I would reduce. And, you know, I even have one sauce that's just it's just supermarket sauces all mixed together. And it's my kid's favorite sauce. I do it all the time. it's like ketchup and bulldog sauce and the Korean garlic sauce and just a bunch of different sauces. And I blend them all together and I marinate stuff and grill with it. And my kid asks for it at least once or twice a week. Now, I didn't put that one in the book. But the teriyaki sauce is that idea. And the oyster sauce, it's such a killer addition because, I mean, you know, the oyster sauce can do no wrong. It's just perfect, you know. And it's funny. And what I love about teriyaki sauce is, as you know, we can sort of laugh about it and even disparage it. You know, for many years, people just thought of, you know, salmon teriyaki. I love Japanese food. And you're like, oh, you know, please. But now it's like, it's kind of endearing to me that people understand, because that is Japanese food, right? I mean, the flavor of teriyaki. Now, of course, we could do it in a more sophisticated way, and there's lots of applications for it. But I think that those flavors of, you know, salty and sour and sweet and caramelized and all those flavors that people associate with Japanese food.
Tell me more about the Japanese equivalent of the American diner.
Yeah, teishokuya.
Teishokuya.
Yeah, teishokuya, my favorite. I mean, I still go to those places, and if you came to visit me, I would take you to some of my favorites because, like I said, they still do exist. And when we were writing the book, and Chris wasn't with me for that trip because I was doing photographs with our photographer, and we went to a place in the downtown part of Tokyo, and we went up these steps in this little narrow place, and we got some, you know, mackerel that was just perfectly crispy, you know, broiled with salt all over it, and a mound of daikon with some soy sauce poured over the top, and a bowl of rice, and little pickles, and miso soup. And I mean, I make that every 10 days to 14 days at home. I mean, it's one of my all-time favorite things, and that's what I always, I mean, it's almost boring, how I only order that.
So aside from that mackerel dish, what is something else that you aspire to jam into somebody's repertoire through this book?
This is sort of, for me, the easiest questions. I mean, you know, ebby fry, you know, you buy shrimps as big as you can find. You don't have to be crazy, but, you know, a nice U16 or whatever, and standard breading procedure, you know, flour and egg and panko, the Japanese version of breadcrumbs. They're a little flakier. And deep fried, served with some bulldog sauce, which is, you know, that sort of Japanese Worcestershire sauce, but sort of richer and thicker, a little sweeter, and tartar sauce, if you like, and a wedge of lemon. Awesome. I mean, I haven't met anybody who doesn't just crush that, you know, from little kids to old people. As we were speaking before, you know, a bowl of curry and rice and fukujinzuke, those bright red, you know, multitude of vegetables that have been pickled, really lovely. Menchikatsu, which are sort of hamburgers that are riddled with cabbage and onions and then breaded and fried. Also served with bulldog sauce and fantastic. And you can put them between two slices of milk bread and it works really well too. I could go on forever, really.
It's interesting. You're not a fan of the word fusion, but I know there's a word for the Japanese concept of Western cooking.
Yoshoku.
It's a whole range of dishes that are like super comfort food.
You know, it's the German schnitzel, which became the tonkatsu. It's the curry rice that came from England, you know, via India. That is now, but it's a completely Japanese dish. I mean, some places lean more towards Indian spice, so they'll give a nod to India, but it's still Japanese. And this whole yoshoku thing, what I was talking about, the ebi fry, you know, I used to, you know, years ago, you didn't go to a fancy French restaurant like L'Effervescence in the middle of Tokyo and where it feels like you could be in New York or Paris. It was more like these Japanese chefs. They would have the white toques on, they had neckerchiefs and starch white aprons, but they would bring you a plate of ebi fry. And it was always, you know, when I first went to those places 30 years ago, I'd be like, whoa, like, wow, like, I just totally don't get this, you know?
So, for example, I see you making spaghetti using ketchup.
Oh, my God. Anything made with ketchup is good.
Expand on that.
Well, it's, you know, I first have to say that my dad, who didn't cook a lot, one of his dishes was ketchup and spaghetti and fried smelts when I was a little kid, and it was one of my favorite things in the whole world.
So that set you up for Japanese home cooking, actually.
It may have. And Chris and I, we went, I took, you know, when I told Chris about this spaghetti Neapolitan, he was intrigued. And he said, I want you to take me to a place that does that.
Ivan wanted to go to all of the cool places to eat in Tokyo, the Kappa restaurants and the izakayas, and show me like the really inventive, creative side of Tokyo cooking. And I was like, well, tell me again about that spaghetti with bacon and ketchup. And we went into this basement restaurant, and it's just all these kind of like salary. Everyone's wearing a crisp white shirt. And they're all smoking cigarettes outside, and then they get their number called, and they go inside, and they just, like, wolf down this gigantic steaming plate of spaghetti with a salad that has, I think, ranch dressing on it. And the spaghetti is always served uniformly everywhere you go with Tabasco sauce and the green can of grated Parmesan cheese on the side. And it's just, like, a perfect working lunch and absolute sacrilege for, you know, practitioners of Italian cuisine. I'm sure, Evan, you're dying a little bit inside right now.
No, not at all. I am an embracer of all.
Well, you should embrace this one because the ketchup spaghetti is super delicious. And something about cooking it down takes away a little bit of like that kind of cloying sweetness of the ketchup. And it doesn't taste like you took spaghetti and squirted ketchup on top of it.
All I can say is that I'll announce here and now that I think my entire life is driven to figure out how I can just have ketchup on everything. It's my dirty little secret. I love it.
I've been speaking with Ivan Orkin and Chris Yang. Together, they wrote the Gaijin Cookbook. Coming up, we're turning to a cuisine some say is defined by its inauthenticity. My conversation with Chef Joseph Centeno about Tex-Mex when Good Food returns. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman.
To be able to, like, take someone back to, like, their childhood and remind them of their grandmother's cooking or their mom's cooking or places that they used to eat with their family. I mean, that's everything.
Chef Justice Centeno is known for his modern interpretation of Tex-Mex cuisine at Bar Amman, downtown L.A., and now a mesita in Culver City. He'll readily tell you that the only thing authentic about Tex-Mex is its inauthenticity. He has a lot of thoughts about it, and he recently put some of them down in a new cookbook called Ama. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
It's so great to have this book finally, A Modern Tex-Mex Kitchen.
Thanks for having me on the show to talk about it.
You have this amazing pedigree on both sides of your family. So let's talk a little bit about that. Who is Ama?
Ama is my great-great-grandmother, who I was fortunate enough to be able to experience her cooking at an extremely young age, obviously, but I have very vivid memories. Her and Apa lived on the west side of San Antonio on Rivas Street, and we'd never go through the front door for some reason. It always through the side into the kitchen. And she had a little 3x3, two-burner stove with a little plancha and a little 30x30-inch kitchen table with those like old-school metal chairs that had like the plastic laminate over the seats. And it always being like 100 degrees plus. And
you'd stick to the seat.
Stick to the seats. Those are my memories with the smell of borracho beans and fideo and fresh corn tortillas being made.
So her life before arriving in San Antonio was like a movie.
Yes. As we started to really kind of get a sense of that when I opened Bar Ama. I went back to talk to the family, and this was like almost 7 years ago now, looking for the inspiration for the dishes that I would be recreating on the menu. And that's when we started to get a sense of like their struggle, and like many times over.
Talk a little bit about that. Your great-great-grandmother and your great-great-grandfather met when they were young and got married, and then they were separated during the Mexican Revolution.
Yeah, so this was like around 1918, is so the story goes.
And she was actually a camp follower, right?
Yes, she was a soldera, and the solderas would be on top of the trains while the soldiers were in the cabins, and they were en route to somewhere, and the front of the train got like bombed by the opposing, like the enemy, and they were separated, and separated for like 5 years. And what she would do was that she and her mother-in-law, they would make the tacos dorados and basically fry these tacos.
So they were street vendors.
Yeah, essentially.
It's incredible. And then they found each other.
Yeah, because she knew that if he was alive, if he was going to come back, it was going to be through the train station, which was the only way to get there.
So is that where she set up her table?
Yeah. And they were reconnected.
That's just so crazy. So you have this amazing pedigree on one side. And then the other side of the family is the supermarket side.
They were the grocers. And my dad was a butcher. And I mean, everyone, although they didn't know each other at the time, were living in northern Mexico. Because my mom's mom, Amanapa, were from Guanajuato, but her dad were Irish and Polish immigrants and living in northern Mexico. And then my father's family were Spanish and French, living in northern Mexico, living their lives like everything's fine and dandy. Everyone's like has little businesses and so forth. And then the war breaks out and everybody loses everything. And they flee to Nuevo Laredo and San Antonio. And that's where everybody like started their lives over again.
And what I love about it is it's such a good example of food being the thing that knits survival back together and then thriving.
Exactly. I mean, it's really, when I cook Tex-Mex, I'm honoring the struggle of all of these immigrants. I mean, this is just one story. There's many stories, many, many. But everyone who, like, they were rebuilding their lives were trying to recreate the food that they knew using the ingredients at hand. And, I mean, that's how Tex-Mex was born. I mean, Tex-Mex has never claimed to be Mexican. It's an American regional cuisine. It blends many, many different cultures and has tremendous amount of influence. Canary Islanders, for example, many years before brought cumin, which is why you don't see cumin in Mexican cooking
as much. Oh, that's so interesting. But, I always wondered that.
But it's used like a ton in Tex-Mex and like Southwestern cooking. And so, I mean, just the influence of people's palates and memories like coming together to create really amazing food.
So did Ama have a signature dish?
Well, the one that I remember, like, aside from the beans and the fideo, is her enchiladas, which are not like the enchiladas that everyone's used to. It's not doused in red sauce or green sauce. Hers are very simple, fresh-made corn tortilla that's she would like kind of roll in a little bit of corn oil and then roll queso fresco and some chopped onion. And then she'd always have a little like potato and onions, garlic on the stove. And that's kind of where I took the idea for making a sofrito. But it was basically just spooning over these kind of rough chopped potatoes, onions, tomato, and carrot on top of just warm corn tortilla with queso fresco. And it was like, that's what I thought were enchiladas in the beginning.
Why wouldn't they be?
So
I have to tell you, every time I talk to you, I get very, very hungry. The experience that you've gone through of being imbued in this food and wanting to honor it, but also express yourself, is really interesting to me. So talk a bit about how you do that. How do you look at a food that has, like, let's say nachos? It's a food that everybody knows what nachos are, or we think we know. To some people, nachos are just what you get in the movie theater with that horrible liquid cheese and pickled jalapenos and really bad tortilla chips. How do you take something that has so much like baggage and sort of put it through your own lens?
Well, it's complicated. Not the cooking part, but like just to kind of backtrack, the origin of Tex-Mex is very much, I guess, would, for lack of a better description, farm to table. These families that started restaurants and like trying to do what they knew how to do in Texas, and we're making food from scratch and recreating dishes from wherever they're coming from in Mexico, but using the ingredients at hand. Then the commercialization of, like, they took Tex-Mex and they blended it with Mexican, and they basically said, this should be worth 39 cents.
Yeah, they bastardized it and made it into a super cheap commodity.
And so that forced, I mean, the families out of just trying to acclimate to take shortcuts, to start integrating processed foods, because that was the only way to survive. I mean, you see the same struggles today. It's like picking and choosing. But that is what kind of pushed what Tex-Mex cooking was and then kind of what people perceived it to be. I mean, there's a good and bad side. One, that it introduced Tex-Mex to a huge audience, but then it stops there. And then it was just bad. And then the garbage that it created thereafter. Back to your question as far as like nachos, I think just practicing making everything from scratch. We fry our own tortillas, chips, every day. And our tortillas are made the day before to our specs, because it is important, like the thickness and like how fresh the tortillas are, but they do need almost like some time to cure. And
then the cheese.
And then the cheese, in the very beginning, I tried every, like I didn't want to use Velveeta. Although growing up in Austin, I mean, that's what was used. And I mean, and I have very fond, I didn't actually have queso in San Antonio growing up. It wasn't until I went to college for a few years and had, Austin's a big queso town. And that's where I fell in love with queso. I grew up more with the compuestas, which was like the more composed style of shredded cheese melted, which is just as delicious, but different. But I tried every, like using like bechamels and like beurre mayonnaise and different like mild and sharp, and nothing like worked. Exactly. It's either if you're going to use shredded, you got to do compuestas. If you want queso, it was just finding the right ratio
of Velveeta.
Of Velveeta, because it's not straight. It's I use it more as like a binder
Because you have a pretty complex combination that you're working with.
Yes, and we started integrating the Brew Bruce, the Argental, which is amazing. And, I mean, you don't have to use, I think if you can find something similar that will add that richness, you could probably, I mean, you could use even like a Brie as a substitute because it is maybe a little bit more difficult.
But it does like make you reach for another chip.
Like that layer that it adds to the cheese is very comforting.
So recently you've opened Amasita.
Yes.
In Culver City. And like the name would suggest, it's a little ama.
Yeah.
How did you decide what would go on the menu there?
When I opened Bar Ama, the idea was to start taking like a healthier approach, like start integrating more vegetables in the menu because vegetables are extremely important in the way that I cook and the way that I like to eat. And
I mean, even with Paco Mercat, when I first started going there, to me, it was just like all about the vegetables.
And so I was basically taking the angle of doing Tex-Mex, but more vegetable focused. And I think it's settled more as more traditional Tex-Mex, as the more like comfort style, which I was like okay with because, I mean, that's what made people happy.
Do you have the vegan queso downtown too?
Yes. Vegan queso was developed there because I wanted, I mean, at the end of the day, our job is about trying to make people happy and saying like, you can't have queso because you're dairy, you can't have dairy or not having dishes that were already gluten-free. It's like, I always think about those parameters and I didn't want it to just be like an afterthought. So I wanted to create, like develop a queso that was just as delicious. And we often have people who order the cashew queso, the vegan queso, but add chorizo to it, so. Which is good.
I mean,
I'm not, as far as the calories, I'm not going to.
No, but that's picking and choosing, right?
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Joseph.
Thank you, Evan.
I've been talking to LA chef and restaurateur Joseph Centeno. His new Tex-Mex restaurant in downtown Culver City is Amasita, and his latest cookbook is Ama. Now we turn to a taquero who's also defying the concept of authenticity. I'm learning about him from LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega. She recently got back after maternity leave. Hello.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're so happy to have you back, Patricia.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be back.
Where are we headed to?
Today, we're headed to Lakewood. So when I wrote this review, I got a lot of feedback. Where is Lakewood? That was one of the main questions I got. It's close to Long Beach. So if you think of headed towards Long Beach, you're in the general neighborhood.
But see, I love that. Now there are a whole lot of people who never heard of Lakewood who are going to go to Lakewood, right?
That's right. Hopefully they'll go to Chinito's Tacos and have some tacos.
So Chinito's Tacos, we have to ask about the name.
Yes. So Chinito's means little Chinese boy in Spanish. And I have a short discussion about it. And that's actually one of the main questions I had for the chef owner of the taqueria, Beeline Crouch, how he came up with the name of his restaurant. And he told me a story about working at a Mexican restaurant. And he is Cambodian American. And his fellow chefs, all of his friends, nicknamed him Chinito. And in a lot of Latin American countries, the name is used as a term of endearment, but obviously it's a fraught term.
Because it's Pan-Asian. It doesn't differentiate between all the separate countries and identities.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people would say this is a derogatory term. It's stereotypical. It's obviously lazy, not taking the time to learn where people are from, just kind of stereotyping this wide swath of people and population and saying, well, if you're of Asian descent, I'm going to call you Chinito. His take on that is he's embraced the nickname. It was given to him by his friends and colleagues, and he thought it was a perfect name for his restaurant. And he said I asked him if he's gotten any kind of negative feedback. He says just a couple of negative Yelp reviews, but most of his regulars understand the tenor of the way he's using the word. So he said he has not received much negative feedback for the name.
And he has this incredibly interesting first name, Beeline, which also has a story.
Yes, there's so many interesting stories with names. It's a fascinating restaurant. So Beeline, as I mentioned, he's Cambodian-American, and his parents immigrated to the Long Beach area. As you know, Long Beach has one of the biggest Cambodian-American populations in the country, and they were refugees from the resettlement periods of the 1970s and 1980s. And his parents chose the name Beeline because they had to make a beeline to Long Beach. And I asked him, is that the name on your birth certificate? And he said, yes, that's my name. It's Beeline. And it's such a great name. And he's such a charismatic, friendly taquero. If you go into his restaurant, he's a kind of restaurateur that will ply you with free samples. He had no idea who I was. And I walked in there and he's like, you have to try my cauliflower. You have to try my Brussels sprouts. His employees are equally friendly. So it's got a great vibe.
So the first photograph in the review features the burnt cheese tacos with shrimp.
That's right. Yeah. So one of his best-selling dishes is a burnt cheese taco. If you're not familiar with the burnt cheese taco, it's essentially exactly what it sounds like. You take cheese, you melt it on the flat top, you shape it into a taco shell, and then you use it instead of a flour or corn tortilla. It's become quite popular with people following a keto diet and people looking for kind of wheat-free options for dining. 100% cheese taco shell. It's even more delicious than I expected it to be.
Really?
Yeah, so I ordered it a few different configurations. I ordered it with the carne asada. I ordered it with the shrimp. I think I tried it with the barbacoa. You get just that great contrast of textures. You get a really, really hard crisp followed by just the intense softness and lushness of the guisados and the braised meats that he uses as fillings. It's really delicious, and it holds up surprisingly well. I think I ordered one to go just out of curiosity to see if it would make it to my house in one piece, and it held up better than some tortillas do. It didn't fall apart.
One of the things that's intriguing about his menu is how eclectic it is. So could you speak a little bit to some of the dishes that sort of reveal how eclectic it is?
Yeah, of course. So Beeline being Cambodian-American, he brings a lot of the flavors he says he grew up with at home. It's really an interesting constellation of flavors. So he says some of the dishes were inspired by Cambodian dishes that his mother would make. Some of them were inspired by Taco Bell drive-thru that he remembers from high school. And an example of that, he's got a great side dish of cauliflower, and he dredges the vegetable in a rice flour. He says the way his mom used to with the fried chicken, and it creates, as you know, just a really nice crispness that you just don't get with other kinds of flours. He uses a lot of ingredients that we associate with Southeast Asian cuisine, a lot of Japanese, Chinese. So, for example, the carne asada, he uses ponzu to marinate it. So
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it gives it just this really unusual and really nice brightness that you don't get from more conventional carne asada preparations.
But it doesn't make it completely Asian.
Yeah, so he really does speak to this very specific Southern California experience. I relate a lot to him. We're both first-generation kids. We're around the same age. We're just that experience of having one foot in each world. And what does that look like when you put it together on a plate? And for him, it looks like a pollo asado with lemongrass on it, or the barbacoa. He uses his own five spice, his Chinese five spice marinade. Gives the meat a really lush, lovely depth that you don't normally, flavors you normally don't get from barbacoa. So you get new things, and you get a lot of, he says, happy accidents, you know, playing around in the kitchen.
So are the tater tots one of the happy accidents?
The tater tots are one of the happiest accidents. They are delicious. He makes them fresh there. They have little crisp bits of garlic, if you love garlic, and I adore garlic. They're kind of smattered all over the place. He uses cotija cheese, so it's that white, salty Mexican cheese. And together, it's wonderful. And if you really, really want to go crazy, you can get it with an egg on top. You can get it with pickled onions. You can get it with some of the guisados piled on top. Yeah, really fun, just really unabashedly flavorful food.
Wow, sounds so good. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me, Evan.
That was Patricia Escarcega, restaurant critic for the LA Times. Find a link to her review of Chinitos Tacos in Lakewood on the Good Food website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. The LA Times launched its first food show this week, and it's all about going deep into LA's unsung neighborhoods. After the break, I'm talking with the show's host, Lucas Peterson. Stick around. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. If you've been following the new look LA Times food section, there's a good chance you know the name Lucas Kwan Peterson.
You go 30, 40 minutes in any direction, you can be in a completely different place and learn something you've never known was there and have a wonderful time and a wonderful experience and frequently eat really, really incredible food.
Maybe you saw his ranking of fast food French fries or watched his hilarious videos, like the one in which he tries to peel garlic. Now Lucas is producing and hosting a new show for the LA Times. It's called Off Menu, and it launched this week. Over 10 episodes, he explores some of our city's most interesting neighborhoods with the help of some friends. Hello.
Hello.
It's wonderful to have you.
I am very happy to be here.
So the Times decided to create its first series. The fact that it sits inside the food section isn't really a surprise for this kind of first enterprise, right?
Sure. Yeah. I think of all genres and different kinds of things you can find in a publication, food makes the most sense as far as just being able to showcase the diversity of the city. And I think food's the obvious choice for that. Yeah.
Did you pitch to someone or did they come to you?
As far as the series itself or like actual episodes?
The series itself.
I mean, I was hired with the understanding that I would do something like this. Yeah. So I'd had a show at Eater, and then when I was being hired for the Times, they're like, you know, you do this video stuff. This is something that we'd really like to start doing. And so I knew that this was going to happen.
You know, I can't talk to you about this particular subject without talking about Jonathan.
Of course, please.
And, you know, when I think about Jonathan's legacy, I mean, he got in his truck, he drove to places in Southern California many of us had never been to before to have a meal. And in doing so, he changed our perception of where we live through this decades-long project of his of exploration, investigation, aka eat, and then write. So it felt like gaps between neighborhoods got smaller and understanding of who we are got larger. And I feel like this project of yours is an extension of that desire to learn and connect.
So much of it is inspired directly or indirectly by Jonathan and his work. Absolutely. I think he was such an ambassador for the city, and in his writing and in food exploration for myself, is how I learned to love the city. And I think it's the most effective way to get to know people and cultures and to come to embrace a city that sometimes is hard to embrace, especially for people who are transplants like me. I've been here since 2007. But it was like I learned through Jonathan that the fractured nature of LA is its greatest strength as far as food goes. And it's how you end up having these incredible pockets of food.
Because the Times now has so many people who write about food in a more far-flung geography than previously, is this show meant to sort of back up those reviews with more sort of back-of-the-house insight?
I think maybe complement. What's nice is that these episodes will clock in at 12, 13, sometimes a little longer, which is nice to sort of have the space to get to know people and to have an extended conversation with someone about who they are, where they're from, what they desire in life. And like, this is sort of what makes LA a wonderful and magical place that you can really get into in a way that maybe you couldn't get into in 800 or 1,000 words, you know. And it's also not criticism in the way that, say, a review is, but it's really meant to kind of color in the spaces and the gaps and to really have a really fully fleshed out picture of these or a more fully fleshed out picture of these people that make our food and make LA such a special place.
And if the first one that dropped, which is the only one I had access to, the one about jazz from Jit Lada, is an indication, it is very much about the person. Talk to me about the decision to start with her.
I mean, do you work in food in LA if you don't have some sort of relationship with jazz? I don't know if you do. She's such a, you know, in the epic play that is the story of LA, you know, she is such a, you know, a vital character.
She knows everyone,
and the decision to start with her seemed natural. She's such a larger-than-life character. She's loved by so many. She was very loved by Jonathan, and vice versa. And so it seemed like a really natural place to start.
And I love that you meet her at a market. You meet her at Laxi, which is the airline hangar-sized Asia market.
Absolutely.
And the thing about jazz is she's totally unfiltered. She tells you what she thinks and what she thinks you need to know.
Yeah. She's like, you know, don't get that. That's terrible. And, you know, was your mom a good cook? No, my mom was a terrible cook. She was absolutely horrible. And yeah, she's so wonderfully and refreshingly herself at all times.
Jazz, tell me about the first year you opened this restaurant. What was
Nobody
it like?
Here. Oh. I sell only $80 lunch. $200 dinner, and I steal my husband's credit card to pay for all the market bill, but he didn't know that time.
And the decision that she made, I think, without your knowledge even, was to cook a meal that was home food, meal that didn't represent items that were necessarily on the menu.
Absolutely. And it won't necessarily be like that for every episode, but it just happened to be that for this, Jazz was like, let's just cook and let's go to Laxi or Thai Costco, as some people call it, and just buy some stuff. And she ended up cooking a whole bunch of dishes that they don't serve at Jit Lada. And it was incredible.
Describe the paste.
The nam prik gung, and then there's an accompanying recipe by Genevieve Koh, our cooking editor, is this fiery, powerful, funky, shrimpy paste that's meant to sort of go with other things. So you can, you know, you dip little bulbs of Thai eggplant in it and you enjoy it like that. Or you could sort of eat it on its own. But it just makes you cry. It's so powerful, and you can see the beads of sweat dripping down, you know, my head in the episode as I'm eating it, and it's just so fresh and fiery and shrimpy, and it's amazing.
And it was really fascinating to watch it unfold in the mortar as more ingredients that were unexpected get added to it.
Sure. Yeah. What was unexpected to you?
For me, the cooked shrimp was completely unexpected.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, to complement the shrimp paste.
I was not expecting that at all.
Yeah. The sugar goes in and the paste and the cooked shrimp and then so much more lemon than I would have thought.
And the amount of chili was
like, I love volcanic.
When she tells you to reach for a bag in the refrigerator at Laxi.
Yeah.
And most of us are used to buying bird chilies like two at a time or three at a time if we're like at a regular grocery store.
Right.
And this is like, there's thousands of them in there.
So many.
I love it. She says, you can take some home.
Yeah. it was an amazing education in cooking, and I'm really grateful to have had the experience.
Tease us with another couple that are coming.
Sure.
That show sort of different takes that you're going to do.
So one really interesting one. So the next one will be the Tacos 1986 guys, which is interesting. So they're the very popular taqueros that have recently opened a place downtown, and these guys grew up in Tijuana. So what we do is we actually end up hopping in the car and going home. We'd go to Tijuana, and they take me around to some of their favorite taco spots. And that's a really fun episode because it again has the driving component, which somehow seems essential to any show about LA and food in Southern California. You mentioned Jonathan with the truck. I mean, so much of it is just like getting in your car and going. And so that has a fun road trip aspect. And then we do one in Skid Row, in which is a little bit different than the rest, but I think it felt necessary to do. It felt like an exploration of chefs and restaurants in a more traditional way is obviously how most people are used to consuming food media, but that there's a huge swath of population for whom that's not that important. And I was interested in seeing how do people eat and how do people feed themselves and what are some of the organizations that are helping provide healthier options, provide sustenance for people who are homeless.
Is it behind the paywall?
No, it's on YouTube. Oh, yes. Oh, I have to promote it. I totally forgot to do that. Okay, so we have a brand new YouTube channel. No, it's not behind the paywall. The YouTube channel can be found at youtube.com/LA Times Food, which hopefully is easy to remember. And the episodes will come out every Tuesday. And the first one came out today. And it'll come out every Tuesday for the next 10 weeks. And you don't have to pay for it. But please subscribe to the LA Times.
Yes, subscribe to the LA Times so this magical food content can continue and thrive.
That's right.
Thank you so much, Lucas.
Thank you.
That's Lucas Peterson, host of the LA Times web series Off Menu. The first episode is up on the LA Times Food YouTube channel and on latimes.com. New episodes come out every Tuesday. After the break, we close out with a look at an underappreciated herb. I'm talking with food scientist Harold McGee about oregano. Don't go anywhere. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman.
So yeah, there's a lot of variability, plant to plant, species to species, genus to genus. That's what makes it all so much fun.
I don't think any herb affects me as deeply as dried oregano, especially the Mediterranean varieties that come in little bundles, like a bunch of flowers, only dried. The aroma is singular and transports me simultaneously to memories of cooking and eating in both Italy and Greece. But serve me a dish made with fresh oregano, and I immediately want to push it away. For years, I've wondered why, so I thought it was time for a conversation with Harold McGee, noted food scientist and author of On Food and Cooking and The Curious Cook. Hi there.
Hello, Evan.
So do you have the same thing about oregano, or do you love fresh oregano?
I actually have never really noticed a big difference between the two. But I think that's probably because my encounters with fresh oregano have been rare.
Oh, that's so interesting. So talk to me a bit about oregano, the plant. What family does it belong to?
It belongs to the mint family, and it's a native of the Mediterranean area. And the mint family includes lots of other aromatic plants like thyme, rosemary, sage, lavender, and in fact, there's a different species in the Origanum genus that gives us marjoram. So even within the oregano genus, there is lots of variation between plants.
Yeah, I have to say, I've never understood marjoram as a flavor either. I've never really enjoyed it either fresh or dry.
Well, it's interesting because the dominant aroma compound in oregano is something called carvacrol, C-A-R-V-A-C-R-O-L. Carvacrol is a very particular molecule. It's a little bit like thymol in thyme. You know, they're both kind of aggressive and very, very characteristic of those herbs. But these plants in that family have lots and lots of different volatile molecules, different aroma molecules in them. And it depends on the proportions as to the, you know, the sense you get of them when you cook with them. And it turns out that marjoram doesn't have a lot of carvacrol. It, in fact, has things that are more reminiscent of pine trees and even a little bit of turpentine. And that's something that is also more prominent in fresh oregano as opposed to dried oregano. Does that sound like the kind of thing that you object to in those herbs?
It's interesting because it means that it's more kind of resinous. But I love rosemary. Like, rosemary is one of my favorite herbs. So is there a lot of variability within those two sets of plants that goes beyond just species or varieties? Does it matter where it's planted?
Yes, it does. And in fact, you know, the offspring of a given plant, depending on their growing conditions, can have very different sets of aroma compounds and proportions. So it's especially with these plants that put so much of their resources into making these aroma compounds, which, by the way, are defensive. We can enjoy them as human beings, but they're actually meant to deter insects and small animals and so on from chewing on them.
What's really fascinating to me about oregano is, I guess, when I first discovered how beautiful it could be in abundance was with Greek cookery, where often with meats in particular, or even on cheese, it's used with a lot of abundance, as opposed to Italian food, where it's used in very specific dishes in just a very small amount for accent. The floralness of it, I guess, has always appealed to me, and it doesn't seem to become acrid like thyme. To me, if it's used too much, can be sort of acrid. Also, rosemary can, I mean, it's easy to go overboard.
I think that probably has to do with the sources of oregano that you rely on, because, again, in my experience, I haven't focused as much on it as you have, clearly, but in my experience, I don't get that much variability from bunch to bunch or sample to sample. So I wonder whether you've over the years been able to kind of figure out which ones really match your palate, and those are the ones that you're able to get.
Well, what fascinates me is you can get really great Greek or Turkish Mediterranean oregano from most spice companies, and certainly from mail order spice companies like Penzies or the Spice House. But then you can also get oregano in these little bunches that come kind of very inconveniently packaged on the stem.
Uh-huh.
And they're always marketed as, quote, wild, like wild Sicilian oregano or mountain Greek oregano. And they look different. The actual little flower and leaf parts that are dried have a bit of a different look to them, and they are so supremely aromatic. It just seems like a completely different plant.
Yeah. Well, they could very well be completely different plants. I mean, that's part of the challenge of loving these herbs, is that, you know, we're not there seeing them harvested. We don't know where exactly they came from. We're depending on the various middlemen in the process to, you know, select the best stuff that's out there. You know, I can remember I went to Crete once, long time ago, 20 years ago, and drove around the island with a botanist, and we just, you know, picked at the herbs that were growing along the roadside and in the fields near the roadside and so on. And exactly the same species, according to the botanist, would have very different flavors depending on, you know, where we were finding them. They're just really variable plants and give really variable effects.
Also, there's the completely separate plant also called oregano, which is Mexican oregano.
That's right. Mexican oregano, it's in a completely different family. It's in the lemon verbena family, but it happens to produce the same kind of characterizing molecule of oregano, which is that carvacrol that I mentioned at the beginning. So it has that character, but then it also has very different sort of supporting cast of volatile molecules, which is going to give it a different kind of flavor.
Yeah, it's fascinating because to me, I mean, there are certain dishes that if you don't use Mexican oregano, it will never taste right.
Yeah. And there's another plant that's called often Cuban oregano. Sometimes it's also called Mexican mint, which is really confusing, but it is from the mint family. It's not the regular oregano species or genus. It comes actually from Africa. And it also has carvacrol as the main component. So it does smell at first blush like oregano. But again, it has a very different set of supporting smells and gives a different effect when it's cooked with.
It's interesting. I was talking to Steve over at Rancho Gordo, and he also markets something that he calls oregano indio. And I asked him what it was, and he said, basically, it's just a wild herb that the communities that he, the bean growing communities that he works with, pick, and they just call it oregano, even though it doesn't look anything like oregano. It has that similar lemony, earthy, but less floral aroma to it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing about the plant world that there is this kind of profusion of molecules and combinations of molecules that that give us different effects to play with.
Yeah, I just love how geographical cuisines are. So I'm curious, what is your favorite use for dried oregano?
Actually, you mentioned on cheese with a little bit of olive oil, nibbling and sipping a glass of wine and chatting with friends. That's what comes to my mind first.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go make some lamb chops with tons of olive oil and garlic and oregano on them.
Sounds wonderful.
Thank you so much, Hal.
Okay, thank you, Evan.
That's food and science writer Harold McGee. We've been dishing on oregano. That is it for our show this week. In case you missed any of it, as always, you can listen on our website or you can listen on KCRW's mobile app. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, leave us a review, please, if you liked what you heard. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Chuck Previtary, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Jacqueline Kim. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more Good Food.